community, grief, and the sacred practice of men's business. Welcome to the Vital Veda Show. I am your host, Dylan Smith. I'm an Ayurvedic practitioner and holistic health educator who is very grateful for all the wonderful people that I get to interview on this show in the fields of health, consciousness, spirituality, personal development, relationships. It goes on. And today I am joined by a very dear friend of mine in person, as I love to do podcast episodes in person. We're in your house, Tony, in Bondi, Sydney, Australia, in a special room of the premises where here a lot of things happened: meditation initiations, meditation groups, and particularly this week, there's a lot been going on. We've been practicing our Ayurveda clinic in Sydney out of here, and last night you had a men's ritual. Tonight we have a grief ritual for a shocking death in our community that happened a few days ago. And what else is going on here? A lot's going on. How's the space feel for you evolved over the time? And now we're doing this podcast in here.
Yeah. For me, there's definitely space is really important. And I feel coming into a space where a lot of work's been done, a lot of deep work's been done, you can actually feel as you go into that space the impact, which is really, there's a ripple effect there because you move into that space and everyone feels that ripple. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And so I just want to introduce yourself quickly. Well, I'd like you to introduce yourself, but I'll start with, you're a good friend of mine. You have worked in facilitating kind of roles in your corporate world, and now you've started doing this in men's work. I mean, is that a pretty good word to explain men's work? I don't know. It's hard to put into a word or two. How would you explain this men's business or men's
really,
work?
Well, it's interesting. It's such an interesting question. And Dills, it's such a pleasure to be here. Yeah, I'm really, when you mentioned the idea of doing this, I can really feel the timing's right for this.
Great. Yeah, it's been a long time coming, I should say.
Yeah. it's interesting that we call it men's work when, if I think of some of the older cultures that I've explored, they didn't think of this as men's work. This is just the way of being in community with other men. Hmm. And so there was a natural way of being which involved being together intimately. And now it's kind of, because it's so unnatural as a natural way of being together in the world, that we kind of need to create spaces where it can happen really potently. But it's interesting. It's almost, for me, the word community resonates more than men's work. But it is. Men are doing the work that they would otherwise be doing in the regular flow of life. You know, a hunter-gatherer might be out hunting and they might be having a conversation. And those conversations and connections are happening throughout the week and throughout regular rituals that are holding the frame for all of that intimacy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So tell us about yourself and how you got to men's business, because you grew up, or you started kind of working in corporate. And you're moving more and more towards facilitating these intimate groups, which I was a part of, Man Tribe, which is your company name and your movement name or the community name which you're creating. And that was a profound experience for me, again, dabbling into men's work before that. And then that was an opportunity for me to go really deep into exploring myself and tapping into parts of my emotional self and my masculine and feminine, and really like very holistic exploration of self and of life and of relationships for me, and going into topics and parts of my life that I haven't had an opportunity to go so deep in a men's group, and in a group, I think, is a big thing about that.
Yeah.
So that was very, very beautiful. And yeah, how did you get there? Tell us a introduction of yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I have like a really different background. I'm an accountant by training and spent time running a social enterprise in my 20s. But I think I really felt passionate about coaching and mentoring. That was something that felt really important to me. And so I went and spent some time in that world. And that's kind of my day job. I've trained as a coach. And for the last 6 or 7 years, I've worked with executives and with senior leadership teams in facilitation roles. And there's loads of barriers in that context to having the real conversations. And there's so much politics in those environments. I felt within myself a yearning for more depth, and it felt difficult to do it there. So so for me, that was part of the call to kind of start exploring this in men's community. And you were part of that too. You were part of that journey too, in terms of, you know, tugging on the thread, saying this is something I think we should be exploring.
Mm.
But I think in my own life, something that I started to observe was school finishes, you go through university, you start working life, you start a family. The years are rolling by and the intimacy that I have with men is starting to become more fractured and more distant and more remote as the years pass. And I think that for me, that was the deep calling. You know, it's like this is the work that keeps me off the streets as much as it as much as it is for the men, is to keep coming back into that place of intimate community. I look one generation up and I have a lot of heartache when I look at the kind of people in their 60s and 70s and 80s, and I see that where that should be the stage where these older people are stepping into eldership and are stepping into really playing a critical role in community, in tending to the needs of the little ones, that they kind of become isolated and there's lack of friendship and there's so much need there. So for me, this is kind of a, you know, most of the men that I'm working with are in their 30s, 40s and 50s, and they have a level of maturity that they've been weathered a little bit by life. They kind of understand that, wow, you know, trying to find a sense of purpose is actually difficult. That takes time. And trying to navigate relationships is not always easy. And the corrosive element of all of this is doing it on their own. That's what makes it. I've got a story that's just popping up. Do you mind if I share it with you?
Yeah, but before you do, I just want to add a side note early on in this episode of the why this episode is relevant for other genders other than men, because I feel that you were talking about a yearning for connecting with men. That's what you got you in this. But I feel with the work I've done with you and your programs, it's significantly, probably more so, definitely connected me to men and my brothers and my male friends, but it's really helped connection to my wife, and my family and parents and all relationships, essentially.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. And I think that the potency of this work in time, in the fullness of time, will come with bringing co-gendered groups together and doing some of the healing, some of that healing work that needs to happen across the whole fluidity and spectrum of gender. But that's a different conversation.
Yeah. And I think even like, for example, for other genders listening to this episode that's primarily focused on men's, I think it's nice for them, or it's supportive for them to listen to this in order to get an insight for the men in their lives. It's like, okay, it's not for them to push their men in lives to do men's work, quote unquote. But I think knowing what's out there and then just playing that role of support and just having that knowledge of what's available and what can be done.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Great. So yes, you love telling stories. And perhaps before, yeah, why don't you tell a story and then you can tell us the power of story and why you love stories.
Yeah. And it speaks to actually what you were just saying. And I don't, I should say this absence of true community is definitely not something that is just something that men are afflicted by. This is something that is a cultural transition that we've been going through for literally probably since agriculture. Tens of thousands of years we're talking. But this one comes from a fellow that I'm really inspired by. His name's Francis Weller, and it's a true story, as opposed to many of the ones we've shared around mythologies. And he went to go and visit a village with an elder, Maladoma Somme, in West Africa. And it's the community is Dagara people, so it's the tribe. And he said, first of all, it was just for him an experience of just seeing what true community is like, and how he described the tears flowing walking through this village and seeing, you know, at the time when we normally have happy hour, you know, 5 p.m., they had their version of happy hour, which was multiple fires around the village and kids running amok with bare feet and parents kind of bickering and telling stories and laughing, and there was dance and there was music, and you couldn't tell which child belonged to which parent. And the only time you'd know it is that at the end of the night, a a parent will come and pick up their child from the earth because they're falling asleep and take them back to their hut. Any child would feed off any lactating mother. And he said one thing that did kind of bother him was he saw this one young girl who looked like her face had been mutilated. And the following day, he approached Maladome. He said, you know, I'm really curious what happened to that girl. And he said, oh, that's a good story. So her mother was going through a really hard time, and she was a bit unstable. And in a fit of rage, she took a boiling pot and she scorched her face with it. And that's what left the scarring. And you know, that's a sobering story, because you hear about village culture, you think, oh, it's really easy to romanticize village culture. And I think we need to be really careful about that. He said what was important was what happened next, which is that she wasn't sent to prison. She wasn't punished. She was held in, the mother was held in community. This is a woman whose needs are not being met. We need to work with her and understand what's going on. And more importantly, what happened with the little girl, which is the aunties and the grandmothers spent loads of time with her, because they knew if they didn't spend that time with her to help her internalize an understanding that this was not her problem, that this was her mum's problem, and this wasn't something she needed to take personally, it was nothing about her, that scarring on her face wouldn't be a skin scar, it would be a bone scar. It'd be something she carries with her for the rest of her life. And I love that story, because I think in the absence of true community, which is what really, to me, we all live in this culture, we all live in the absence of true community. I'm talking like the safety net of a village. Then we carry those scars personally. We take things which shouldn't be taken personally, really personally. They get internalized, and the shame is really silencing. So, you know, we were sitting in this room last night talking about the topic of sexuality with a group of men. The level of shame that we hold as men around sexuality, and then the corrosiveness of that being a non-existent conversation, that we can't have that conversation openly with one another. That's what does the harm. It's not the experiences themselves. It's the fact that we don't have the holding space when we're young to contain those, and then we carry that through life with us. And as Francis, that man I was talking about, would say, the longer we carry that grief with us, the more it starts to congeal, the more it starts to harden, and the more we start to kind of live smaller versions of ourselves, just, you know, this kind of shrinking down. And that for me is not a story of actually men, the needs just of men. It's a story of the real need that we have for community. Yeah.
So powerful. I love it. I had goosebumps when you were telling it. And storytelling is a big thing in your life, and a big factor that you integrate into your facilitating that you do. Why is that?
I think one of the meta contexts around working with men is that we have a culture where vulnerability and expression of emotion is seen often as weakness. And so just the act of being able to get men to soften into really sharing their deeper stories, that involves work. You know, it's not fair on men to sit down and say, hey, you know, start talking about your sexuality. And so I find that stories are really, they're like acupressure points on the emotional body, you know. And as we share a story, whether it's a story like the one I just shared, or it's a myth. But often in myths, we have encoded within them deep archetypal patterns, you know. So there's often a story I tell about father-son relationships early on in the program, and it really details the remoteness between fathers and sons that exists in our culture. Not always physical remoteness, but certainly emotional distance that many men experience. Every man can find their way into that story. So it almost, I feel like the tributaries of all of the men who show up in the room, they all flow into the river of the big myth that we're all a part of. So you hear a story that kind of hits on much bigger patterns that go beyond an individual man. Every man finds their way into the story, and suddenly we're having the deep conversation where to just sit down and ask a question sometimes can be very powerful, and particularly later on when men have that intimacy. You don't need a lot to get men sharing from the heart, but certainly earlier on it's useful.
I'm sure people experience that from that story, that softening.
Mm.
And it's like a, it's kind of like a feminine energy.
Mm.
It's a soft, it's a breaking tension energy. It's create, sparking creation and like child. I found it very, you know, we all associate storytelling with children. And so it activates that for me, that innocence, that ability to, yeah, just kind of transcend those relative rigid systems or emotional patterns that we're in, or I don't want to open up. And it's just kind of, okay, I'm a child. I can express whatever I want.
Yes.
That's what I felt.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. It stimulates spontaneity and expressiveness. Yeah. Yeah, I had a man on one program say, you were sitting there with a drum and telling a story, and it was so goofy that I thought if you could do that, then it put me at ease to kind of be myself. I was like, oh, it wasn't really the intention, but great, you know?
That's great.
That's great.
I want to just go back into how you got into this. You said you were yearning a connection with men.
Mm.
I would just love you to comment on your own yearning and also from the people that you work with.
Yeah.
Because I definitely, you also mentioned witnessing the 50, 60, 70, 80 year olds, those generations now in 2023 who are perhaps in overall a lot more disconnected in intimate relationships and lacking that openness and yeah. So
yeah.
Is that what was the big... Because that for me is like a clear thing happening in my father's generation and my father's group of friends, for example, and maybe to an extent my grandfather's, although I didn't have too much time to and insight into it.
Yeah, and I would say on a deep personal level, I've noticed an inflection point at the point of having children. The point of starting a family... I was the remoteness was already starting because I didn't have that containment of school or that containment of university. You don't have those spaces where you're seeing people regularly, you know. So if you're at TAFE or you're at wherever you are, if you're in an environment where you're in a contained space, it forms part of that village for you for a period of time.
Yeah.
But then you kind of, you know, start working life and you're moving across different projects and suddenly that intimacy is it's more dispersed.
So essentially, it's like isolation and loneliness. To a level.
Big time.
Yeah.
Big time.
Which is really the opposite of community.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And that the model that we have of everyone living in their little boxes. I think about it here. You know, we've got a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old. And, you know, they're prepping their meals, one house to our right, and doing everything in their own little home. And two houses over, they've got the same situation. Across the road, they're doing the same thing. It's like, surely we could organize ourselves in a more intelligent way here. But that busyness means that we're in a state of constant just doing stuff.
Mm.
And it's a really nice excuse to avoid intimacy because at the end of the day, when you've been literally from like 5 a.m. till 7 p.m. attending to other people's needs, there's really very little to give. There's very little to give. And so I think that the inflection point happens around that time. If people choose to have a family, it becomes radically more apparent that separation is now very, very clear. But I think for me, where the actual moment it happened, I was sitting with a dear friend and we were having a conversation in a cafe, and he shared really vulnerably, and I don't know how we got into that. We were good friends for a long time, but for some reason, I'd never heard this from him. And he shared about his relationship with his mother and some really challenging experiences they had around risk of suicide growing up and the emotional weight that they had kind of had to bear and the impact of that on his life. And what was so, and I got to share a little bit about my own journey with my own mother. And what was so powerful about that was I walked away feeling, first of all, just really like, oh, so much more at ease in that moment. Just like, wow, I really saw myself in that man's story, and I really think he saw mine. So there was a feeling of communion, definitely. But the bigger question I was left with was, we've been like really good mates for over 10 years. How is it that I didn't know about this thing, which is, it's not like it just happened and hasn't continued to affect him. It affected his life continuously, which got me questioning, how deep are these connections that I have with friends in my life? Do I really know these men? Am I really there for them in times that they have need? And my own reflection was, I actually think I'm not really actively reaching out when I'm in a time of need. So, you know, that happened, and then we had a little chat, and it was a kind of, there was a yearning for more intimacy with my own father and feeling that that was hard work. And that really started to shift, but from years and years of us being devoted and dedicated to the process.
Yeah.
So I think it's, I have a, there's a therapist that I know, who says the first thing he does every time he sits down with a new patient is he has a rock that sits on his table. And he says, the work that we're doing operates at geologic time. So he has no watch on his table. He says this work operates at geologic time, and the soul often operates at geologic speed. So we need to like know that this stuff takes time.
Mm.
This work takes time. It takes time to soften in, and it does.
It does. Yeah. But I feel also it can also, it's not like it takes very long, as in, I'll share in my personal experience. When I started doing your program, like, that was, how long was that program? Like 3 months, was it?
3 months.
Even in the first few weeks, like, I was feeling that in more intimacy in my relationships with my wife, father, and siblings, and everyone, and my brothers as well. And when I say brothers, my friends, my male friends. And of course, it's continually been increased, that intimacy, and that's giving me a much greater sense of fulfillment, a much more richness in life, that presence that I bring. Like, for example, yesterday I went to dinner with three men of my friends, and I don't usually do that much. Like, I don't hang out with men that much. And I went in a car with one of my best friends who I've known literally since I was a baby. And just and I was so happy that I got to drive with him, just us two, and I could have conversations to the dinner and back. And, you know, the conversations we were having, that level of depth, we've only started having maybe the last two, three years when I've started doing this work more. And I've known him literally my whole life. But more importantly, the richness that gives, the connection, the love, the feeling that we get when having those. I mean, it's... And it's so important for mental health, for emotional health, to also release things and not suppress, like you said. And when you look at the statistics as well of longevity and the studies of blue zones, which are the centenarians, you know, people try to work out, what is it that make these people centenarian? They look at their diet and they can't get it because the diet's so different in like Japan and then Mediterranean and all these parts of Asia, and they can't work it out because some of them, and they're smoking cigarettes as well, like, and drinking wine and things. So, but it's all community. That's the big thing. And that's the massive thing with mental health and in the statistics of suicide in Australia, at least, and I'm sure other parts, is it's mostly men. I think it's 75 or 85% men. And I think, yeah, that's a massive thing. So, yeah, that ability to open up and connect on a deep level is...
Yeah.
I don't know, just what kind of want to share, like, why is it enticing? Why is it important? I just share, but why would you say it's important to be able to have deeper relationships and intimate connections with other people?
I mean, I think it's a core human need. I think it's just a core human need.
And that we've just lost, we've just numbed.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think one of the commentators I love following, he says something that is a type of grief which is hard for us to put our fingers on, but it's kind of sits there in the background, is the things that we come to the world expecting but don't receive. And those are, the way he describes it, he says, for 200,000 years, we've lived in community. So our bodies expect that intimacy. We expect ritual. We expect music. We expect storytelling. We expect abundant play. We expect meals eaten slowly under the starlit sky. These are not romanticizing it. We expect ritual. Our bodies respond to ritual. We expect to be comforted in times of grief. These are just core human needs. And so it's the reason I love that framing around the things we come to the world expecting but don't receive, is because they're absent from the world. Doesn't mean that our bodies aren't acknowledging that there's something there that's missing, that I kind of know that it's meant to be there, but I can't really, you know, and I sit around a fire with a group of executives and they pour their hearts out. And then afterwards, they're like, I can't believe we shared all of that. It's like, yeah, I know you do. You're just, yeah. Your body's encoded with this. Mm-hmm. We're encoded to have that communion together. It's really unnatural not to. And so, you know, I heard someone say recently, they said, you know, the saddest part of it is that when we don't receive that, what we came to the world expecting, and there's no community around us to help us appreciate that it can still exist, we start to attribute that missing, that absence, as a failure of our own personalities. It's like it's something wrong with me.
That's so interesting.
And there's nothing wrong with us. There's not, and that's, you know, one of the men last night, he said in our closing checkout, he said, I just love this because the work is deep and sometimes heavy, and I always leave feeling so light. And I thought that was such a great way of describing it. It's like when you have true communion, and we kind of can scrape away all the bravado and all of the defenses, and someone risks putting their heart out, they kind of, actually I feel a bit edgy around this. Suddenly the whole space starts to open up. People say, actually, yeah, I really feel that too. You know, we talked about men's sexuality last night. And I don't need to talk about, and I can't talk about the content of last night, but I can share, you know, just as one example. So many men experience anxiety around premature ejaculation. So many men experience anxiety around I hate the term erectile dysfunction, around not being able to get an erection at the moments they want it. So many men feel shame around things like pornography, or experience, you know, having gone out and experimented with sex workers. These are all men trying to kind of grapple with these things that they end up internalizing as my own kind of fault in myself. Where actually the second you sit in the warm light of community and people say, actually, yeah, I kind of feel that too. And, oh, wow, that I hear that man across from me tell my story, but through his mouth.
Yeah.
Suddenly there's something very deep that goes on within a man's body. You just see them settle. Oh, okay. It's not just me. You know, yeah.
What else are some of the biggest challenges that men are facing?
So I think to start with, like what we just described, the isolation is a huge one, which couple that with the kind of a poet that I love, Martin Shaw, says being strung out on the infinite rack of progress, this kind of conveyor belt of progress that we live our lives on, which means that connection becomes more and more hard to find.
Yeah. I just want to say about that connection, because you mentioned it's ingrained within us. I loved what you said earlier, like just listing all those rituals and community and village. It was so beautiful. But in my experience, and I'm really like keep referring to my experience in this episode, because I learned once in a men's walk, some men's work, that you never say, like, I'm not going to say we feel, I'm not going to speak on behalf of the culture, and especially because of this work, speak from the eye, especially with this work, there's so many people from different, you know, upbringings and different societies, and some might have a very different relationship to their parents than another person. But from what I see, we're basically numb to that experience. Experience of connection is so absent from our lives, and it is so ingrained from us, but I feel like people are ignorant to it. Like, yes, you're born with it, as you said, but like, I can't remember ever knowing that.
Yes.
And only when I did with you, it actually was so easily accessible. It came quick, but I don't think I ever had a memory of ritual of these things that you talked about.
So the two great sins, I'll go back to Francis Weller, who I quoted earlier, the two great sins of modern culture is amnesia and anesthesia. We forget and we go numb. And those are two powerful coping mechanisms, really powerful coping mechanisms, which maybe help us to kind of to allow ourselves to cope with a world where we feel like there is all this richness and all this stuff, which if we're lucky, I said it to a friend recently, in my own world, sometimes I feel like I get those things, but at the fringes of life, kind of in the gaps, I get them, a little moment here of connection. But that the fact that they aren't front and center, and when we don't have it front and center, we don't have ritual, we don't have intense experiences of community, the laughter of friendship, that joy of real friendship, all of that, you know, we kind of fall back to secondary needs. And the secondary needs are food and television and drugs and anything, you know.
Entertainment.
That can numb us and keep us busy, keep us busy. I had an experience the other day where, and I like your self-responsibility, so I'll take some self-responsibility here too. I was driving on the way to check out a retreat venue for a group of leaders. And it was a 1.5 hour drive. And I was like, oh, what podcast am I going to listen to? I was like, oh, I'm going to put something on to fill the space. And then as I was doing that, I noticed, wow, I've got all this kind of, this emotion that's sitting here. That's kind of, I can feel it. It's like eruptive. It's right there. And I want to listen to a podcast. I want to fill the space with something because otherwise I don't know what to do with that. And I just pulled over on the side of the highway. And I could just feel this energy pulsing through, you know, it really needed to move in my body. I would feel tears flowing. And it was so relieving to be able to pause and just have a moment. Oh, wow. That's just my body needing to process the fact that I'm living this life at the moment, which is so compressed, where we have no space for personal need. And I think all of that stuff that we fill our lives with, you know, I wonder, you know, if you can't go on a 4-day bush retreat, you know, lock yourself in a bathroom for an hour and a half. Seriously, like just allow the body to start to just actually come into relationship with what is going on in here without your phone. You know, yeah.
So I think a way that I want to reframe that question of what are some of the other, you know, challenges that men are facing, but I want to integrate that with the Man Tribe program, because we spoke about loneliness and community, but I mean, we talked about sexuality as well. So what are some of the other topics that you offer at Man Tribe program? Because that's kind of what I think is it's the key elements of what this work addresses and what it supports.
Yeah. With. I think, one of the things is I would, so there are content areas that we explore that, you know, I'm learning more and more that those content areas are actually, they're scaffolding to have the deeper conversations. Yeah. That's all they are. You know, and it's useful scaffolding, but the truth is actually what a man actually really can take from the experience is starting to expand their emotional amplitude. It's kind of, you know, not having that height and depth of emotional amplitude means that we flatline. We don't experience high emotions of joy. We don't experience high emotions of true connection and love. And we also don't experience the other side of it. Grief and so our unwillingness to go down. Who was it that said it? There was a poet who said, you know, the greater the sorrow, the deeper the sorrow, the greater the joy, something like that. So I think, and I will answer your question, but I think I'm realizing more and more that it just creates the scaffolding for men to start to exercise that muscle of emotion. And then, you know, if I take some examples from last night, men starting to say, oh, like that practice of actually expanding my emotional amplitude is something that I'm now finding in my relationship. I'm having some deeper conversations. And that's an offshoot. That's a byproduct of that exercising that muscle. I have to share it just as we're talking about this. We're talking about men's work before and how this was just so embedded in older cultures. There's the Maasai people, and I refer to their rite of passage process. I know you did a podcast with Anna recently, and I'm really inspired. I was so amazed by their rite of passage process. So some rite of passages is like a 4-day process when kids are, you know, 14, 15. Their rite of passage process is about roughly 12 years. But it's really when the initiate, when the person going through, the man going through the rite of passage is ready, that they decide that they're initiated. And it starts at around the age of 18 and it ends when they're about 30. And the initiation is helping the man to work with high emotion. Because from a Maasai way of thinking, that passionate, eruptive energy that exists within the masculine It also exists within women, but it's of masculine flavor. If that doesn't learn to get tempered, if that doesn't learn to get supported with elders that are paying attention for a very long time to help men, nudging them this way, nudging them that way, from the Maasai people's perspective, this man is not fit to be with a woman. Mm. Can't be with a woman until he's gone through that initiation. And I kind of noticed that in my own life when I have like eruptive anger, and it's like, wow, I'm trying to learn this now. I'm trying to learn some of this stuff in community with, you know, with peers, just with others that are also doing this journey. Robert Bly talks about a book, The Sibling Society. It's like, in the absence of having elders to do that process with, we're kind of doing it together, trying to figure out a way together with peers that are kind of muddling our way through. So I really, when I think of that Maasai people, it takes the edge off for me a little bit. I'm like, wow, they had 12 years to go through their initiation process. And we have like, you know, I'm Jewish, so are you. We have a bar mitzvah. It's like, you know, it's like there's very little that is initiated in me after that experience. It's a beautiful ritual, but there's very little that's changed afterwards. So I think the initiation is the process of coming into proper relationship with our feelings. We talked about challenges before. Proper relationship with our emotion. The appropriate reaction to a relationship that's frailing, and the fact that I might, you know, and this happens in the program. I hear from men who, you know, they might end up separating from their partner and they've got kids, and all of the proper response to that is grief. And when we're not responding appropriately, we really need that warm light of community to be able to hold us in that space enough for us to say, okay, I can relax into the truth of what this experience is like for me.
So humbling to hear that Maasai experience, that's 12-year process, and it's a big process. And like, I feel that, you know, even within the work that we do and that is available in our modern culture, we still got, you know, a long way. We got a lot of evolution to happen in order to generate and provide that framework for being able to process emotions, essentially, and learn how to interact with them. And
But to answer your question, because I didn't, we explore father-son relationships. We explore mother-son relationships, and there's some really strong archetypal patterns in our culture around the family system, where you have fathers at least one generation up who were, you know, reasonably focused on work, mothers who might have not had a lot of needs met, and that those dynamics and how they play out in a family system. And men find it really comforting to hear how common the themes are of how, you know, how that impacted them. We explore, you know, the world of male emotion. We explore sexuality. We explore intimate relationships and how we form intimacy with partners. We explore a sense of purpose in a man's life. And we explore the topic of grief. And there's loads of gratitude and appreciation that sits around all of this, because to step into all of this kind of deep work, you really need to balance it with kind of the joy and laughter and play of, you know, I think last night we talked about sexuality and it was really deep. There were some things shared that had never been shared before by men, and there was so much laughter and we really needed that counterbalance in the room, you know? Yeah.
I want to just kind of go back to basics in this of what you just said, is sharing something that you've never shared. And for people listening who've not done any of this type of work, I had that same experience, and it's very common to have that, is you're having conversations that you've never had before. You've spoken about things you never speak about. And it's the standard thing with the status quo of men's conversations, particularly as we were saying in those elder generations of it's like, yeah, you just common conversation about the weather and the temperature of the water in the ocean and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, maybe a bit of some squirmish kind of, I don't know, superficial, grungy comments of your sex last night or whatever.
Yeah.
But, yeah, having those conversations for the first time was so amazing for me, and really was part of that whole opening up and feeling and sharing and intimacy with my friends and peers.
I love that you've experientially, you're doing this work, because I think it really it's been a real honor to watch you grow and to see how you take, you know, some of the work we did a few years ago, and it's just you just this is a practice. Someone said to me, relationship is a spiritual practice. That's such a great way of going beyond the kind of just the solo spiritual practices we think of, and starting to see those, tending to those relationships. If we're on a spiritual journey and we're having all these incredible spiritual experiences and all of our relationships are fractured and not working, there's a point in time where we have to slow down enough to say, what's going on here? Because there needs to be an integration process of that sense of peacefulness that exists here and the rupture that exists here. And I think, interestingly, a lot of the men that I see come into the program are on that journey. They're at that inflection point of, I'm curious about spirituality and I'm doing that work and I'm noticing a need here to build intimacy and to improve my relationships.
Yeah. And emotional. Like, it depends on the spiritual work, but that's definitely was with me. And I see it a lot being deep in the spiritual community here. And, I've been meditating for over 20 years. I do this stuff a lot, but only, I don't know, what was it, 5 years ago, 6 years ago? I don't know how long. Like, I actually started exploring more this emotional work, this men's work. And I see it as a big missing piece in the yoga and Veda, Vedantic community. And we also saw that with why we're running a grief ritual tonight, because we had a shocking death of someone who took their own life, and they were a meditation teacher, very deep in the community, advanced in their practice, in their teachings, in that way, in the Vedic way. And just because also they committed suicide doesn't discount that level of knowledge and experience into the Vedic wisdom and the Vedic experience of spirituality. But perhaps, and very probably, there was that emotional aspect not addressed. And I think we need to be holistic in the work we do.
Yeah.
And not only just meditate. And on another level, like, it's different, but like, I see it being an Ayurvedic practitioner, a health practitioner, a lot of people just meditate and focus on their mind and their consciousness expansion, but don't address the body. And then in also in this conversation, they're not addressing emotions to the extent that they're doing other work.
Which I love you brought that up. You know, emotions show themselves in the body. I was working with an executive yesterday, and we were midway through a conversation, and I could see her body. She was at the edge of her emotional limit, and her body was starting to move. She was uncomfortable. Yeah. She was squirming in her seat. And you see this. You see that this is actually, I really trust the body. I trust the body much more than I trust the mind. You know, stories, we talked about stories earlier on. The mind can be really slippery and can be really, there's a magician in everyone's mind that slips and comes up, weaves stories about the way I see myself in the world, the way the world is. And those stories can sometimes be really expansive and sometimes they can be really contracting. And so I really trust when people's body, you know, the body is the best sign that someone's starting to be ready to do deep work. Whether it's before they join a group or it's in a group or they're in, I'm sure you see this too in your own work.
Yeah.
It's like the body is the one that holds the wisdom.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I want to talk about grief. You mentioned that was one of the things you do in the program. And of course you work with tonight, we're doing a grief ritual, which I'm really excited, because I've never done one. And I also haven't had much experience in my life of grieving at all. I haven't had that many circumstances in my life where it's very, you know, sad for me, to be honest. Not that I, you know, I've had grandparents pass and different, like, but yeah, just explain like what about grief and what's also about the grief ritual. Like, why are we doing a grief ritual for someone who passed away?
Yeah. There's so much we could talk on this topic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
the first thing is that tending to grief was never done in isolation. The older I get and the older we all get, we start to realize you have aging parents. There's sorrow about the state of the world. There's sorrow about what I described before, all these things that we're yearning for that we're not receiving on a regular basis. There's all this sorrow that kind of swirls in the soup of people's lives. And I always go back to traditional cultures because I really trust in the wisdom. You know, you see all these traditional cultures came up with things without communicating with one another in different continents, but they came up with the same processes. And one of the things they came up with was, how do we tend to sorrow in the community? Because no individual was meant to bear the grief of their life in isolation. When a person felt pain, the whole community could feel that. There was a ripple and it was experienced together. And so when you look at the culture we live in, we tend to our grief in, if we tend at all, if we tend at all, we tend to it by ourselves. And we have a moment of quiet tears, you know, away from others. There's shame around grief, as if there's something wrong. And because we're in an ascent-addicted culture where things are progress-oriented and things, it's all about what you can show people about your status and how great we are and the next Instagram, all of this, you know, it's all so image-based. That's one of the central organizing principles of our culture. And and those traditional cultures really understood that you need to feed the soil with nutrition of the cult. If you want great things to grow in this community, you need to feed it. And most of those cultures, I know many of them that used to have grief-related ritual on a fortnightly basis. The women, the older women, the elders would start walking out into the mud and they'd start stamping and the community would come out and they would dance until 3 a.m. and they'd find ways to release their grief. When there's an acute grief, like a lost person, many of the African cultures used to say, they need our tears. They need a river of tears so they can flow to the afterlife. And so, to me, grief is a threshold emotion. It's an emotion that when people can find their way into accessing it, it unlocks all the stuff in our life that seems unavailable otherwise. We don't realize how much smaller we become for not being able to express grief. And it's those moments. You saw me on the top of a mountain 4 years ago, just really finally, and it was a long time coming, really soften into the grief of some of the challenges I feel I experienced in my own life. And those are transforming moments. And we aren't meant to do that alone. We aren't meant to do it alone. Someone said to me recently, they said they lost a parent about a year ago. And they don't live in Australia. And they arrived in Australia. And after arriving, they said they just had all this wave of grief come up because their people are here, their community's here. And so the moment that they were surrounded by community, they had the safety to suddenly start relaxing into the truth of their experience. So I feel that community is essential for grief. And ritual is very powerful because it brings, encoded within it, it brings patterns that our minds can recognize. And so it helps us to soften into the process, as opposed to sitting around in a brightly lit room and say, you know, let's talk about grief. It's really hard to do that. But to bring ritual and beauty into the process, it seems to unlock something. Yeah. For me, there's some alchemy in it. I can't describe it in concrete terms.
It's so many layers to the alchemy because it's beyond your personal metabolism of the emotions and the situation, but it goes ripples to the community. And if it's someone who's passed, it ripples to their spirit. That's why in the Vedic tradition, you grieve for about 10 to 13 days. And I love what you said about the African saying of the tears are helping them flow into the afterlife and the next realms.
Yes.
That's like with the Vedic tradition, it's that grieving, you know, is responsible. But then after 10, 13 days, that's when they're kind of really next realm they're moving to. And it's kind of like, okay, now we have to see it from a different perspective and have that light, that view of the light of it all, and seeing that soul transition and evolve.
Yes. And the bypass, the bypass is the not allowing that sorrow to flow in. Because when we allow the sorrow to flow in, there's a ripening effect. We start to ripen in our relationship with this experience of loss, and we can really, if we really allow ourselves to grieve, we can also really appreciate the joy of this person and their continued presence in our life, and that the relationship is continuing to evolve through absence, that it's still there, it hasn't gone. But I feel like we can't do that really authentically, we can't do that truthfully if we haven't properly allowed ourselves to say, you know, actually, I'm really going to miss some stuff about this person not being here. You know, there's all this there's all this stuff I really enjoyed about being with their body, and that, and that's not here now. And we need to connect with that.
So how do we do it, Tony?
Well, you got to be here tonight.
I mean, I'll just say now, like, I kind of feel Tony can facilitate anything. I feel you can facilitate anything. Like, so I'll just put it out there. If you want to have a grief ritual for yourself, whether you live in Australia or not, you can contact Tony. He can help you with that. He offers various services. And as I said, I think you can facilitate anything. Like, I remember when a good friend of ours broke up with her partner, she was undergoing a lot of grief, and you played a big role in allowing her to process that through your mentoring, you know, one-on-one mentoring sessions, or so many things you offer. But I think it's, I'm really happy about tonight that it's happening for the community, because I feel that, you know, I've never been to a grief ritual, and probably all of these people haven't, I'd assume. And it's a service that you're doing. And I hope that others can take that service, because we need that support in how to grieve. So beyond grief rituals, would you have anything else that you'd recommend that people do when they're experiencing sorrow?
I think we really need to, we don't need a men's group in order to tend to that sorrow. You know, you can just contact a dear friend and to sit in real community with them. And sit around with three people and say, I just want to pour my heart out about what I'm experiencing right now. And I'm not asking for you to fix it. Nothing's broken. I'm just looking for, I just need you to be with me through this, you know? So I think, something, and it's, I've already designed it, but I haven't had the space to actually work with it yet, is I've had this vision of creating, of exploring the old-time village approach to a way of tending to sorrow on a regular basis. You know, having a quarterly ritual around the seasons where people can come together and tend to sorrow that's entered. And it's not the same group every time, but it's a community. So there's some familiar faces, and it feels like we're doing this together. So that's something that's sitting there, it's sitting in the ether for me. But I don't think it needs to be ornamental. I don't think it needs to be a ritual that we're waiting for. I think the vulnerability of, before we had this podcast, you said, I'd love if you could share some kind of practical things. You know, I'll share something that I'm doing with a friend at the moment. We catch up once a fortnight, and we're doing it for a few months, and it's absolutely lovely. But we also found that it's really easy for us to talk at that superficial level. We know how to do that. It's really easy for us. And one of the weeks I said to him, hey, I've been playing with something with the men's group. I'd love to explore it together. And the way it works, it's really simple, is write five emotions, strong emotions on a card, you know, peace, joy, anger, shame, sadness, whatever that, five strong emotions, but core human emotions. And then for 3 minutes, uninterrupted, I'm going to start sentences that start with, I feel sad, and finish that sentence. I'm not going to explain why I feel sad. I'm just going to say I feel sad because I just feel like I have so much I want to give to the world, and I have no space in my life right now. I feel like I'm so under pressure, and I feel a bit angry that to rattle off for 3 minutes, you'll probably get 15 to 20 statements out in 3 minutes. And in those 6 minutes of us sharing for 3 minutes each, we know more about each other and our worlds and what's really going on than we would know from a 90-minute chit-chat session.
Oh, for years.
Yeah.
Before you start doing this work.
Yeah. But amazingly, it's you said it, the deep work of relationship healing, that's when I said it's geologic time. That takes geologic time. The speed with which we can drop into our hearts and have the real conversations, that can happen. All we need is the safety of community and someone else who has the slight vulnerability to say, I'm willing to do this. And it opens up the flood, the floodgates.
And these rituals and practices, you said, you know, we don't need a man tribe program or we don't need a men's group to do it, but those provide that ability for someone to access that aspect in their everyday life by themselves with a friend.
Yes.
So I think that's one of the importance and benefits and advantages of these rituals, is because once I do that, I know how to do that, so I can do it myself without a facilitated setting.
That's right. And that, I think, you know, for me, the core, the joy that I have from doing this work is seeing small, intimate, generative communities of men, because those connections don't end at the end of the program. They keep meeting monthly. Mm. They keep catching up one-on-one and in smaller groups all the time. And I'm on their WhatsApp groups, so I can see them all connected all the time. And there's such a warmth I feel in that. It's like, wow, there's all these little groups of men, you know? So I feel like we're all kind of, we all have the opportunity to help support the nutrition, that nutritional need for community that's needed in our culture.
Yeah. All right. I got one last question. Mm. It's probably a big question, but it's a good one, but we can keep the topic brief, and it's about the idea of toxic masculinity.
Mm.
It's a common thing you hear.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like it feels like people who are in this work and in this industry, for lack of a better word, or, you know, being facilitators in men's work, they kind of talk about that as a problem that needs to be addressed, and a reason to do men's work is because of the idea of toxic masculinity. So I'd love you to comment that and also share what toxic masculinity is, not necessarily to what it is to you, but what is this term, which is becoming a bit popular these days.
Yeah. So we've got another 2 hours, yeah? We'll keep it brief.
Challenge to keep it brief.
We'll keep it brief. Bera Akamalfi, an Indian man, he says, toxic masculinity is just masculinity which hasn't learned to meet its trauma. And I think when we talk, there's a real shadow to this whole, you know, toxic masculinity is out there. You know, we're fighting that, and you're here, that's not the case. The idea of toxicity, I hate that term because I think it's a misunderstanding. All it says is there's a human who has deep need, and that need's not being met, and they're expressing it through behavior that's really unfortunate. That's all. It's just bad behavior, and almost always sitting behind a person who's behaving in what we would call as a toxic way is trauma. And is, I've never really been seen. Nobody's ever really wanted to see me. I've never been seen. And the second we open that up and we start to get seen and we take some self-responsibility, you said self-responsibility using responsible language like I heard this incredible story of a woman who was visiting Auschwitz, the death camp during World War II. And she met a survivor of Auschwitz that happened to be visiting at the same time.
Wow.
And she went up to that survivor and she said to her, oh, like, isn't it just terrible what happened here? I just, like, you know, there was so much in her that she was experiencing in that moment. She said, isn't it terrible? She said to the survivor. And the survivor turned to her and said, I mean, it really is terrible, but don't you think we all have a Hitler inside of us? Don't you think we all have a part of us that wants to dominate and wants to control and that's kind of capable of, and I think for me, the absence of doing deep work risks us moving into terrain, which is just unnatural for our way of being. It's not really who we are. It's not what we're about. But I think it's to take responsibility for that toxicity exists in us. It's inside you. It's inside me. To be able to say, you know, there are ways that I show up in my own relationship. I was sharing with the men last night, which I really, I'm not proud about. If that's not spoken, if that's not tended to, if I don't have men holding me accountable, play that out for 30 years. What does that become? You know. So I think that toxicity, and especially some of the behaviors we see in people who might be of an older generation, that's just untended need, which has sat in the body for decades and decades. Untended human needs like community, like intimacy, like sitting around and telling stories and really being seen, all those core needs we've been speaking about, that when you play that out over 30 years, well, of course, if anyone was in that body and had experienced that pocket of experiences, that packet of experiences growing up, and had not been tended to for that long, well, of course, that's how they're going to behave, you know? So for me, toxic masculinity, that is the term toxic masculinity is a toxic term, because it misdirects us to creating a blanket term of, oh, that's just toxic, where actually what we really want to understand is, well, there's unmet need. It doesn't abdicate. It doesn't say that man's not responsible for their behavior. They are responsible for their behavior. But to have the tenderness to say they're really not being met. Mm. And if you go into a prison system, I've spoken with many people who work in prison systems, you just have any conversation with any one of those people and you realize these aren't criminals. These are untended to humans. Mm. They're humans that just have a lot of unmet need that wasn't met when they were young and wasn't met as they aged. And it's kind of inevitable, some of the things that happened. Mm. And we could spend a whole episode talking about the perils and damage that prison systems do, but we won't do it today. Mm.
I was going to ask to share some resources for people to learn more and do move more towards this work. And one of them was that movie we watched at your place with some men. What was the name of that movie?
It's called The Work.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
God, that's an amazing movie. I highly recommend. Tell us.
Yeah, so you can find it on Apple. It's only available on Apple iTunes, and it explores a body of work done which was so remarkable. They took civilians and a group of people within a prison, maximum security prison in America. And they work with them intensively for, I think it's 3 or 4 days, where the civilians from outside and the prisoners from inside are doing the work together. And actually the prisoners have some responsibility to look after the safety of the civilians while they do their work. But they're doing deep work together in community. They're doing deep men's work.
And they've been told to drop all gang... gang tensions.
Affiliations and things.
And that's just for those 4 days.
They're just
which
humans.
Is pretty cool that they all do that. They drop it all and they're all together for these few days.
Yeah.
This is murderers and people who charged for murder and serious crimes.
And the speed with which you can have compassion for those men when you hear their stories is unbelievable. Mm. You know, you just hear a little bit of their story and you really can feel and that they're locked away for they have those sessions twice a year for 4 days, locked away for the rest of it. So that's an excellent resource. I'm trying to remember the name of Anna's book, which is wonderful.
The Making of Men.
The Making of Men is a great book.
By Anna Rubinstein, who's on this podcast also on the topic of rite of passage, which is probably the most related podcast to this one we're doing with Tony.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a wonderful book. Throughout the program, we share resources on every topic. Mm. And I'm really mindful not to overwhelm people with content because it depends on what you're interested in.
Yeah.
For sexuality, you could look at David Data. You could do your own research. Research porn addiction. Research things that are relevant to you, that are your growth edge. David Data is also great for purpose in a man's life. If you're interested in poetry around men's work, you could explore the book Iron John, which tells the mythology of an old story, an old European story, but then that one's a really good one around father-son relationships and exploring that remoteness in that relationship.
All right, that's good. You can join the Man Tribe program and get all the resources. But so I want to hear more about what you offer because, of course, there's Man Tribe program, which we spoke about, which is it still 3 months or how long?
Yeah, it's still a three-month program. Ten sessions run over about 13 weeks.
Okay.
So break week. About every 3 or 4 weeks, and it's run outside of business hours. It's run in the evenings, typically on a Thursday night, from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m.
in Sydney, Australia. And then for those outside Sydney, like if people want to do work with you, can they do online sessions? Like, what do you offer for?
I've had men start to ask about an online version or online experience. So I'm thinking I am toying with the idea of running an equivalent program online. Mm. It needs to be adjusted for it to have, I think, the same impact.
But what about mentoring sessions? Because you've mentored me so much, and particularly me and my wife relationship. Like, if someone wanted to do a consultation with you,
I'm always open to one-on-one chats. So because I have a full-time job, I'm also mindful with the family not to overdo it. In time, I think I'm going to be running an equivalent of Man Tribe, an edition of Man Tribe, which is called Dad Tribe. Because I can see that the needs that fathers have as they make that transition and then grapple with things which our parents' generation didn't have to grapple with, balancing work and family life, having to be really a lot more present in the home, a lot more present with their kids. These are things that men often want, but it creates all this complexity in the family system, which I think having a holding space where we can be in community around that would be very valuable. So I've got that's a program that's already written that hasn't haven't had the space to actually play with. At the moment, I'm running about 2 to 3 Man Tribe programs a year.
So the next one's in the websites?
Yeah, mantribe.com.au. Yeah.
Beautiful. Anything else you want to leave the audience with? Or?
No, it's such a joy, Dil. I feel really honored to sit with you in this way.
Thank you. So beautiful. And yeah, I hope you listening can immerse yourself in this in whatever way. Hello, my dear friend. If you listened to this whole episode, thank you for getting through to the end. It was a pretty special episode with a very special someone in my life who continues to inspire me. As you kind of got an idea, I'm kind of like trying to push Tony to offer his services to extend them to more people, but he very much practices what he preaches and he has his boundaries and he prioritizes certain things. But if you do feel you are not in Sydney and you can't attend Tony's groups, which by the way, his Man Tribe group is happening. There's an intake happening in the middle of September 2023. So if you're a man or you know a man listening to this and that in Sydney, Australia, and would like to join the Man Tribe by mid-September 2023, definitely hit up mantribe.com.au. and contact Tony. And if you are someone not in Australia or you're not in Sydney and you can't meet Tony and you can't do his programs or the program's not for you, then I highly and you want to get something from him, you want his guidance, his consulting capacity and his consulting abilities to advise you on, hey, I just had someone pass away and I would love to do a grief ritual, or I'm getting married and I want to do a rite of passage for myself, or I'm having a baby and I want to do a rite of passage, or I feel like I need a rite of passage. Any of these type of things. I just broke up with my partner. I'm grieving. How can I deal with this? And you want, what Tony is really good is to advise and consult. And I'm speaking from experience and from people that I know who've had his expertise with those situations. So I'm just going to put it out there. Like, I try to get this out of Tony for him to offer it, but I'm just going to say, if you feel any of those things are calling you or a session with Tony would call you, just send him an email and ask him, can I do a one-on-one with you? And he can plan and give you the structures and the things you need to make that happen in a way that's meaningful and powerful and transformative for you. So if you enjoy this episode, take a screenshot, share it with people, share it with people who need to know, share it with men who perhaps need to do men's business and people who need to maybe be more open to this community way of living. And until next time, definitely check out, coming up is an episode with Anna Rubenstein from the Rite of Passage Institute, a phenomenal episode all on rites of passage more specifically. And subscribe to the Vital Veda podcast for that one. Until next time, my friend, much love.